Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owlpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Wishing, and with me, as she is every single week, our fearless leader, Drea Kaufman.
Hello!
Hello! Hello!
Hello!
How has this week been?
It's been interesting. Yeah. My husband has like a recurring eye thing that happens every once in a while, and it's come back this week, which kind of prohibits him from driving. And also all of the eye doctors and things have, you know, limited hours and limited appointments and rules and stuff right now. So it's just been kind of a tiring week. And for those of you who don't know, we record early in the week and then release the following weekend. So it's Tuesday and it feels like Friday. So it's been a week already, but we're pushing through. So
No, I think that's a good way to put it, that it already feels like a Friday and it is only Tuesday.
Yeah.
So it just, I don't know what it is, but it just has felt like a long week. But
it does.
It's crazy because we're at the end here of The Half-Blood Prince. This is the very last chapter.
About to start the last book, and I'm excited and sad and excited and sad. So
I am really excited to get to this last book. It's one of my favorites of the series. I guess I'll spoil it for everybody. I adore the final book. And I'm just really excited to reread it. I've actually kind of wanted to reread it for a while, but of course I've just been kind of waiting because, well, we're gonna have to read for the show. Yeah. And you know, I have plenty of other things to read that I haven't read yet, but I'm really excited that we're gonna get in there and get into the Deathly Hallows. But before we do that, we have to finish The Half-Blood Prince. We're talking about chapter 30 this week, The White Tomb. And want to thank everybody who has joined us. And you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're on Apple Podcasts, be sure to just hit us up with a star rating review. Let people know what you think of the show. When you do, we'll definitely be reading your review out on the show to let people know what you said and to give you a huge thank you. And you can be Owlpost famous. So you can find us on...
famous with us. You know, that's all that matters.
Right. Exactly. Because we're so famous.
we have our haughty laugh down in there.
Oh, sorry. Anyway, you can find us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. We are over at thenerdparty.com, where you can also find us. You can see all the shows we're doing here at the Nerd Party, as well as go to the contact section, and you can send Dre and I an email there. So, this chapter, you know, I thought was really interesting because, you know, Drea, we talked about at the end of the last chapter where the teachers and Harry kind of had a discussion about, you know, what they should do with Hogwarts. Should they keep it open? Should they not keep it open? What should they do? And here we see at the beginning of the chapter, some of the parents come immediately and pick up their children. And I've got to say, I really appreciated that Seamus threw a hissy fit because his mother was going to make him leave before Dumbledore's funeral. And of course, she says they can stay for that. And I thought, you know, just it'd be really difficult to be a kid here at Hogwarts. I've had all this go down and then not be able to stay for the funeral of your headmaster. I think that would be really tough. So, you know, I know parents obviously probably think they're doing the best for their kid and everything, but yeah, it just would be hard to leave at this point after that and not being able to experience the funeral with everybody else.
Well, and I think this represents a key turning point for, you know, a lot of the, I feel like Seamus sort of represents a lot of the like tertiary characters, right? Having a very similar approach to Harry. And if we remember a book or two ago, he, you know, his mom was calling him names. He very much so subscribed to the Daily Prophet thought process, all this stuff. So I think the fact that he both stands up to his mom and stands beside the rest of the Hogwarts students and stays at the funeral really speaks volumes, one, about Seamus's character, and two, kind of about the change in attitude that a lot of these characters that have sort of been on the fringe of this happenings, if you will, are starting to feel, right? They're starting to take it seriously. They're starting to understand where they are and what's happening. And, you know, they're making a decision to either leave or be a part of it. And so I think, you know, Seamus standing up to his mom and who had, I think, I don't remember which book it was. Someone was taunting him about being mommy's boy. I think it was the last book. It comes full circle, and it speaks a lot about just kind of the change that a lot of these students are going through and the change in the atmosphere in general. So I do really love that we get the call out from Seamus, and it's a good way to tie in the fact that the nearby town of Hogsmeade is pretty much overrun with people at this point, which is unfathomable in today's climate that there'd be that many people in one place. But it's really overrun with the wizarding community turning out to show their support and their, mm-hmm. you know, and to bereave for Dumbledore.
I mean, we even have the head of the Beauxbatons school coming. You know, it's, you know, we yeah. have Madame Maxime arriving on one of the, you know, with the magic, the winged carriage, you know, the carriage pulled by the huge winged horses, you know, everything. I think it is a sight to behold, you know, to see yeah. all of these, you know, famous people from around the world, the wizarding community, arriving here to pay their respects for Dumbledore, which, you know, as they should. You know, Dumbledore is a person which we see has had a massive impact on the wizarding community, not just here in Britain, but around the world. Mm-hmm. And so, and of course, you know, he's also been a character who's tried to foster relationship with, you know, people not only in the wizarding community here, but around the world. I mean, we've gotten hints of that. So,
we'll really see as this chapter plays out the impact and the reach that he
yes.
has, right? We kind of get to relive a little bit of that as we read this chapter.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting too, because, you know, Harry is thinking to himself, man, the weather is so nice. This would just be perfect if Dumbledore was alive, because I would just be spending time with my best friends. Like, he's been spending all of his time here with Ginny and Ron and Hermione, as they've just been hanging out together. And, you know, Neville's been discharged from the hospital. And, you know, Bill still looks a little bit apparently like Mad-Eye Moody these days, with huge scars on his face, but at least he has both of his eyes and his legs. And, you know, I really love the conversation between Ginny and Harry, where she's like, ugh, I guess she's not that bad, you know? And I love that Harry's like, I mean, you know, she really isn't that bad. I mean, not as pretty.
He says she's ugly, but
yeah, she's ugly.
I love how he literally does that for her benefit, and she just kind of like gives him a little look and like moves on. Because I think
it's pretty cute. It's pretty cute.
And I think it's interesting because it kind of calls back to the fact that Harry's not really swayed by the Vila in her mm-hmm. like some of the others are, right? And so I think, you know, it's also kind of a reminder to Ginny that like he is not under that spell in any way. So I think it's just super, super cute though.
Well, and, we get Harry there, you know, we're talking about, you know, like, is anybody else died that they know? And luckily that hasn't happened. And, you know, they still haven't found Snape, you know, and Harry's like, of course you're not going to find Snape. You know, you're not going to find him until you find Voldemort, and nobody's managed to do that. So, you know, and in all of this too, Harry is still reminding himself of, you know, what the Horcruxes should be, you know, the locket, the cup, the snake, something Gryffindor, Ravenclaw, and it's kind of almost become a mantra with him. And there's this really fascinating conversation that Hermione brings up, because she's been doing research in the library, of course, and she has found out, not who R.A.B. it was, but she has found out that the character earlier that we had mentioned, Aline Prince, has a relationship with Snape. It is his mother. And so Like Voldemort, Snape has a wizard mother and a muggle father, and so it makes even more sense why he would call himself the Half-Blood Prince. Somebody who kind of touts the fact of what they are, you know, like this whole idea of like blood mattering. And so I just really think that, to me, that's really fascinating. But one interesting question that they raise here is, like, Snape knew that you had to know you were using this book. Like, why doesn't he turn you in?
The whole part is so interesting, in that it's not necessarily Prince as a title, but Prince as a surname, right? And we weren't really expecting that. Nobody really was. And I like the discussion of kind of logically how it all breaks down, and how the conversation goes in terms of, you know, they ultimately conclude that they don't think Snape wanted Dumbledore to know that this was Snape's book, right? And I don't know if I agree. I mean, I agree that if it came out, Slughorn would recognize Snape's handwriting, and then Dumbledore would know that it was Snape's book and all of that. But I don't know that I agree with their ultimate sort of basis of their theory, and that he didn't want Dumbledore to know that it was his, and that that's how he acted. But I feel like that's also kind of based on foreknowledge, or knowledge I have from further on right. in the story. But I still don't know that I 100% buy into that idea that he had this pride. He wanted to save face with Dumbledore. And I do find it really interesting. At kind of the end of this explanation, it comes out that, it would be because he would think that Snape was evil. And I think it's Hermione even kind of says, like, I don't know that I would use that word, but sure.
Well, and two, because that right after that, Harry's like, you know, you kept trying to tell me this book was dangerous. And Hermione's saying to him, the reason I'm bringing this up is because you're putting too much on yourself. You know, this isn't, she's basically using all this to say it's not your fault. No one could have guessed that Snape would have turned into a killer, you know? And so it is interesting that Hermione, in one sense, is saying, like, yeah, he's turned out to be somebody who's really dangerous and killed somebody. The same sense she wouldn't use the term evil. It's like, well, I don't know, just kind of murdering somebody seems to be pretty evil to me, at least for what we know now. Whether or not that, you know, does stay the case for the rest of the series is something that we can't talk about just yet. But I do think it is really fascinating. But one of the most interesting things to me is that Harry's reaction to Dumbledore's death has been so different from Sirius's death, where he's not looking for a loophole for him to be able to come back. Like, he realizes now that, you know, for Dumbledore, this is final. You know, there isn't a return for Dumbledore here, and that he's been carrying around the fake Horcrux in his pocket just as a reminder of everything that it's cost so far, and to remind him of the cost of what's coming. And so I just think that that's a really fascinating thing, that, you know, Harry is taking what's about to come really seriously. And in fact, we'll even see a little bit later on, but near the end of the chapter, just how seriously he's going to take this.
Yeah, it's he's dealing with death in a different way, right? He's growing and evolving, and he's handling it as someone who's seasoned in it, which is sad. And you shouldn't have to be at, you know, really at any age, but especially not at, you know, what, 16, be seasoned in your dealings with death, right? There's a part here that I think it's sort of after the services, but there's a part that really resonated with me where he's talking about he's kind of not necessarily coping, but he basically says, like, he realizes now that he should never feel the way he used to, and that there is a protective arm that if he's wrapped in this arm, it can never hurt him. And that he is always vulnerable, and he always has to be on the defensive, and he always has to take care of himself. And this moment of realization is big. And I think it represents a handful of things. I think we all go through something similar, not necessarily with death, but with realizing our parents aren't superheroes, right? Like, we realize they're people, they're fallible, they have flaws, and they're not perfect, and things like that. I think that piece we can kind of all relate to. But I also find it really sad that he has this feeling that it's essentially he will never be safe unless he makes himself safe, which will never be safe, right? Like, he knows that that will never happen. It's such a strong, bold realization, but it's also so sad to think that he kind of like shuts off a part of himself, I think, to being cared for, to relying on others. And it's hard to read, but it's also so familiar. Right. I think a lot of people or everyone has had that moment where you're just like, I'm going to take care of me. I'm not, you know, whether it be in high school or as an adult or a kid, like you just have a moment where you're like, it's all on me. Right. It really stood out to me when I actually read this chapter twice. Last episode, I read both chapters together and then I pieced this one out for this one. And both times I read it, it still just kind of struck a chord. And to me, it stands out as one of the most one of the saddest statements in this whole chapter, even though we're at a funeral. There's so much else that we should be sad about. That's the part that resonates with me.
Well, there's this really fascinating thing that happens right before the funeral, mm-hmm. which is Harry has a completely different feeling towards Malfoy now than he used to.
Which we talked about. We talked about maybe having a grain of empathy for him. And mm-hmm. we see that this happens with Harry. I think it says something. He has, you know, all this disdain for his love of the dark arts, but that there is also pity in there for what's happening to him and his family.
And that's the thing that I think is, you know, because we saw earlier in the book, and I think this is definitely connected, we saw that Harry was able to feel pity even for Voldemort when he saw the way that his mother had been treated. And the fact that, you know, his mother has been so awfully treated, you know, she sends her son to the orphanage and then dies a few days later, basically. For Harry then to be able to feel, I mean, you think about the hatred and the rage that Harry had towards Malfoy this whole book, right?
Like whole series,
But he sees that he got to witness the fact that Dumbledore was not going to be killed by Malfoy. Malfoy was not going to be the one to do it. The fact that he had been lowering his wand before the other, you know, Death Eaters arrived, and that just hearing that, you know, the tension in Malfoy's voice, the fear in Malfoy's voice, knowing that he was under the threat of violence, but for him and his family from Voldemort to do this. And so what would it have been like? So Harry's even transcending to another level of adult behavior, which is to put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
Yeah.
And so I think we see
there, someone else's shoes, but just even just to know that there's more going on than you can know, right? Like, even just the thought that he's not just putting himself in the shoes, but he's saying, I have no idea what he's being forced to do under the threat of his life. And so I need to look at the situation differently, right? Like, that's a hard skill for even a lot of adults to do. Like, we all struggle with that. And that's, I feel like, one of the purest forms of empathy right there.
And there's this moment, too, during the funeral where Harry is thinking about this idea of all of the people that have stood before him and Voldemort, between him and Voldemort. You know, it was his parents, and then it was Dumbledore, and now there is nobody else, that it is just him, and it kind of connects what you were talking about earlier. And so, you know, this, I think, is almost in some ways, like, connected with that. Like, Harry is...
It's just him and Voldemort now.
Like,
it is just the two of them. In his mind, everyone else is sort of a liability, either in a good or a bad way, right? Like, either they're going to get hurt, or, you know, they only serve a certain purpose. Like, there's just this change in perspective on how he goes about life. And, you know, he's no longer looking at this like, I just want to have a normal life. I just want to go about my life. He's now looking at it like, this is my purpose and the only thing left for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the funeral where, you know, we get so everybody showing up, you know, like, and it's not just people, but it's also magical creatures showing up. We get the mermaids that are showing up there at the edge of the lake. The centaurs that are showing up there at the edge of the forest. Gwop is there.
Gwop is there, yeah.
Which is hilarious. And we have, you know, Hagrid bringing down the body and laying him on this, you know, beautiful table. And I love the moment where somebody is giving this eulogy and everything, and all Harry can start thinking of is the things of that Dumbledore would say that were funny, and they're almost making him like want to laugh, and he's like, what is wrong with me? But there's just, you know, this moment where I think Harry is able to, in this place, it's so sad, but he's also able to remember this man for who he was when he was alive and not just how he is now. I think there's a real beauty to that. I think, you know, anybody that's been to a funeral for somebody that means a lot to them, there is that moment, I think, that everybody has where you end up laughing instead of crying because you just don't have anything else you can do. So Harry is like experiencing that part of losing somebody here, which is, it's just so sweet because it also, I think, really accentuates how close they were. And so, yeah, the whole thing is really, it's just, she does a really good job, I think, of writing this funeral and making it very realistic from Harry's point of view of going through these kind of stages of grief.
Well, and she makes it very realistic too, and how certain funerals, either in a family-wise or, you know, on a larger scale, become politicized, right? Because there's politics within your family, right? There's not just, you know, actual government politics, but, you know, we have Umbridge who shows up at the funeral, and there's a nod to where she kind of gives Hagrid a dirty look when he's sort of sobbing as he goes down the aisle after dropping off the body. And I remember he kind of hints it as like some people are giving disapproving looks to the behavior at the funeral, and he's like, Dumbledore wouldn't care. Like, he would, you know, like, he knows Hagrid, he knows us, he knows how we're responding. Like, he wouldn't care about this. But it's just, it's also, she does a great job of pointing out like the formality and the expectations and these behaviors and how everyone kind of acts differently at a funeral, right? Like, sometimes some people expect you to be very prim and proper, and some people you're crying in the seat, in your seat, and others, you know, are like Harry where you're kind of distraught, but you're just sort of empty. So she really kind of shows all of that, not just the stages of grief, like you pointed out, but just like the varying ways people show up at a funeral, which is drastic. And that's why tensions run high. That's why people kind of lose their heads. And, you know, it's interesting that she shows all of that in this, and, you know, even points out that, you know, people like Umbridge showed up at Dumbledore's funeral, where this is the last place she would be welcome. So,
well, it's interesting too, because, you know, as Harry's having that moment, he's also thinking about like the fact that, you know, Dumbledore had gone to the edge of the water and talked to the mer people. Did he know Murrish? Wow, I wish I had asked them all these questions. And like, he's thinking about all the things now that, too, that he won't get to have a conversation with Dumbledore about. And, you know, I think we're reminded here again of just how important it is to take hold of every moment that you do have with people, because that moment may never come again, you know? And so the thing that is really interesting too here about the funeral, and this is the last time that Fox shows up, is because there is like where you have Dumbledore set on this kind of like slab, all of the sudden a fire erupts and Harry is pretty sure that he sees Fox flying away as this fire erupts, and it turns into this beautiful white tomb that he is encased in. And so, and it's just kind of a really beautiful scene as the funeral kind of ends. And then we get to Harry having a conversation that he kind of alludes to earlier, that he's going to have a conversation with Ginny. And it's the way they handle it is just really adult. It's shocking, you know, like you would think there'd be all this drama, and there isn't. You know, she knows exactly what's coming, and he knows exactly what he has to say. And there, it's just, I love the way it's handled, because again, I think we can truly see just how meant for each other these characters really are.
Well, and we get some insight, because we don't get a lot of insight into Ginny's character, right? We get snippets, we get behaviors, but we don't follow her character the same way we follow the Trinity, right? And so we get some insights here too, and we kind of learn something that we speculated on a while ago, in that, like, one, Ginny's had a crush on Harry forever, not just a girly crush, but like a real life crush, right? And we know that Hermione knows about it and knew about it and was helping kind of advise Ginny along the way. And I think that that's so sweet, and it shows that depth of relationship between Ginny and Hermione that's been developing in the background. And it shows that this isn't just like a schoolyard crush, if you will, right? Like, this is deep appreciation for each other in a way that goes beyond just like high school, right? They've grown up together. They've seen each other grow up, and it really shows that they are connected on such a deeper level that we don't really get to see or experience in any other way.
Right.
And I love that. And I love seeing Ginny. Ginny's also not a character to necessarily be vulnerable. And here we get to see her be vulnerable, and still in a strong way. You know, she tells Harry how she felt. She tells him it's been a while. And, you know, he kind of gets a little emotional. He's like, well, if I had just gotten my act together, we could have had more time together. You know, we could have had weeks or months or even years. And she kind of doesn't really respond to it, but she almost answers like it wouldn't have been as good. Right? Like, we did this at the right time for us. And I just thought their breakup, not breakup, was kind of beautiful. And it was, like you said, like the most mature conversation we'll ever see two teenagers have ever.
Well, and the thing I think is really beautiful about it is, like you said, not only does Ginny get to share herself with him, like saying, look, I've loved you forever. And I waited for you, and I always held out hope that, you know, you would see me and
figure it out. Yeah.
Right. And at the same time, you know, Hermione advised me to also live my own life. And by doing that, I hoped that you would just see the real me. Mm-hmm. And Harry did, you know, and that's exactly what happened. He fell for the real her. And so I think it's kind of beautiful that instead of like getting together earlier, there was this natural progression, right, of coming together, because they were able to see each other in a light that wasn't something that, like you said, was kind of manufactured or anything like that. It was this natural progression of a relationship to move towards from friendship to something else, you know? And I think there's a real beauty in that. And I think that's what allows them to be able to have this conversation, because she also says too, look, I knew this would probably happen in the end, because I knew you wouldn't be happy unless you were out there hunting Voldemort. And maybe that's why I like you so much. Like, she knows who he is. He knows who she is. And they accept each other for who they are instead of trying to change the other person. And I think, again, that's a very adult, like, there are adult relationships, and we already saw this early in this last chapter, where Lupin and Tonks are having a hard time moving forward because they're not allowing these things to happen as naturally as Ginny and Harry are here. So I think Ginny and Harry maybe should give relationship lessons to Tonks and Lupin.
Well, and like you said, she gets to be herself. That's where she gets her confidence from, which is what's attractive, right? He's attracted to her because of who she is. And that's, I think, such an important message for everyone to hear, let alone teenage girls. Like, be yourself. And if that person who is the object of your affection feels the same way, then it'll be great. But if not, it's going to be remote of vain. It's going to be forced and fake, and things, you know, you're not going to be happy. And I really do love that that's sort of this full circle. We get this true character in Ginny, right? We also get confidence as a reader that we know who she is, right? And I think that's all pretty wonderful. And I do love that she doesn't try to change him, right? She's not like, no, don't do that, it's dangerous. She knows none of that's going to do any good. And so she kind of just accepts the reality of the situation. And, you know, as we'll see, as we move into book 7, she'll do what she can to be supportive, but not get in the way. I mean, telling him no and being all these things are only going to make it more dangerous and scary and hard for Harry. And she knows that, which is also very mature. And you also have to remember, Ginny's at least a year or two younger than Harry. So, you know, you've got multiple things happening here. But it is sort of an interesting breakup. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it feels like more of that thing where we're going to pick up where we left off if everything goes according to plan, which is means I don't die, Voldemort dies. You know, it's not like it's the breakup of like, I don't love you or anything. It's just, I've got to do this because I've got to make sure that you're safe, and we know what Voldemort does to people's loved ones. And so I have to do everything I can. I can't have that on my, again, it, she understands all this. And again, I think that's what makes it so beautiful.
I also think she understands that it affects more than just her, right? Like, people who love him and her connection to her family is also going to be at risk. So by her saying, no, we can do this, I don't care, like you see in a lot of other young adult books, Twilight, she would be putting her family at risk, her mom and her dad and her brothers and everyone else would also be at risk if she chose to stay an important character in Harry's life and publicize this. So instead, they have to, for the sake of literally everyone they love, everyone, you know, she knows that this is about more than just her and Harry, too. And, Harry knows it's about more than just him. And, he doesn't want to come home to a burrow without the Weasleys. And so I think there's so much more here. And they both know, and it doesn't have to be said. We get to say it instead of them. So I think it's the mature thing. It's the right thing to do. It's the hard thing to do. And it's nice to see. I mean, there's a choice between what's easy and what's right. And again, we see a Weasley and we see Harry making the choice of what's right and not what's easy. So I think it's beautiful. And it also doesn't mean that Ginny is out of the fight, right? Like, she's not conceding her stance. She's not giving up. She's going to do what she can. And I think that also kind of subtly comes through that, I'll step away from the title so we don't wear an extra bullet, an extra bullseye, like an extra target on us. But I'm not going anywhere. I'm not backing down. I'm not hiding. So
right after that, we have this wonderful moment where Harry basically turns around and he sees Ron holding Hermione and he's like stroking her hair and she's crying. And it's just so sweet because those two have finally found their way to each other. And now it's pretty official because it's out there in the open, him hugging her and stroking her hair.
I don't know. I did not read it that way.
I don't stroke anybody's hair.
Oh, see, I do. I mean, I don't know. I would. I mean, growing up and in high school, I was very huggy. So, I would do that. I, especially at a funeral, I feel like it fuels that romance a little bit, but I still don't feel like it's official, especially because kind of after that moment, there's nothing, there's no hand holding or anything goofy like that. So I feel like their moment is still coming. But I do think though that this is them getting more comfortable with this idea and sort of it's them testing the waters of not caring about anybody else, right?
Right.
Like if he's gonna comfort her, he's gonna comfort her, and they don't care if Lavender sees or Harry sees or Ginny sees.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I think that it's them easing into it. But I did think this moment was super cute and it's very tender, and we don't get a tender Ron. We get kind of a dumb Ron sometimes, which will happen again here in just a minute, where Ron is sort of behind the curve of everyone else, which I love. I love Ron. Don't take that the wrong way. This whole thing is the funeral kind of is this beautiful funeral, right? It shows you all things. You get to see all kinds of things. We get to feel Harry's thought process, as you mentioned, about him wishing he knew more about Dumbledore. I feel like that also kind of plants the seed a little bit of some insecurity that he felt like he had this deep connection with Dumbledore, but he still sort of is reflecting back and realizing how little he knows, right? He doesn't really know much about how he knows Mirmish or,
yeah,
you know, why he did what he did. Or there's so many questions he wishes he had asked and he didn't. So, I think we start planting kind of a seed of doubt as to his relationship with Dumbledore here too. And in the same hand, as Harry walks away from the funeral to take a quiet little walk by himself, he gets, you know, walk crashed by our favorite Minister of Magic. And favorite is heavily, like, air quoted there. Our favorite Minister of Magic, Scrimgeour, kind of hunts him down and asks if he can take a walk with him.
And basically, he's just asking the same thing. One, he wants to know what him and Dumbledore are up to, which Harry is like, I'm not telling
if
you.
If I'm not
that.
Telling McGonagall, I'm not telling you.
Yeah. And then two, he tells him that he's not going to help him with basically lying about what the ministry's doing. Because he's like, have you released Stan Chungpike? And Scrimgeour's face just gets all twisted up and like frustrated.
And he's I love that. You know, he offers him some aurors. He offers him bodyguards. We can protect you. And he's like, Voldemort wants to kill me himself. Not like your aurors aren't going to, they're not going to stand in his way. Like there's nothing they're going to do that's going to protect me from him. He's out to get me. Like it's me and him, right? That same realization we talked about him having in the very beginning. Like he's expressing that to the Minister of Magic. Like there's nothing you can do. So you have nothing I need and you're not doing anything that I agree with. So why would I help you?
And not only that, too, and I mean, we have this beautiful thing where Harry's like, look, you know, as long as people that are loyal to Dumbledore remain here, you know, he'll never be gone.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're Dumbledore's man through and through. And Harry's like, yep, that's right. It's like basically nothing's changed. So,
well,
you know?
And it's interesting because Harry says that very iconic line, right? That as long as those who remain loyal to him are still at Hogwarts, he will be there, right? That is huge. And Scrimgeour's like, oh boy, he's not coming back, right? Kind of playing into what Harry did with Sirius, even though I don't think Scrimgeour knows anything about that, but he kind of plays into that childish version of wishful thinking that he'll come back. And Harry's like, no, you don't understand. You can't understand. And I get that. You're not going to understand this. So we're just going to move on. And I thought it was so interesting because I think it's true. You know, like there's a lot of people who aren't going to understand that philosophy, that as long as that spirit and that thought process and that love stay in Hogwarts, it's like Dumbledore never left.
Yeah. And I like that basically the way that we wrap up this book is that Harry goes and talks to Ron and Hermione, tells them what happened with Scrimgeour. And then he tells him his plans for the next year, which is that he's not going to be back at Hogwarts. He is possibly going to visit Godric's Hollow. And then he has to find these Horcruxes. And so they're like, well, I guess we're going with you. And he mentions he's going to go back to his aunt and uncle's, you know, for the time that he can. And then, yeah, he's on the hunt. And they're like, well, you have to come to the wedding first because Bill and Fleur are getting married there. And he's like, oh, well, can't miss that, you know? And but they say they're going to come with him. And of course, Harry's like, no, you don't need to do that. And like, look, bro, simmer down. We're going with you,
bro.
And there's nothing you can do to stop us.
I love the way that, you know, Hermione sort of convinces him as she's like, you gave us the opportunity. You gave us an out a while ago and you gave us plenty of time to take it. And I think all of our time to kind of get an out to this has passed. And so, you know, that should just tell you that we're in and that's whatever this needs to happen.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, alleviating some of that guilt from Harry. Like, you gave us an opportunity. We know the stakes. Like, we are making this decision for ourselves, not because we feel like we have to. And I do love that when Ron brings up the wedding, Harry's sort of like, oh yeah, it's weird to think about something so normal happening, but it also brought him like sort of a sense of peace that like, it would be beautiful to see something very normal happening amongst this very abnormal situation. And so I love that, you know, he has this moment of like, oh, not only is it didn't seem frivolous or ridiculous or, oh, why would we? It was like, no, that, that actually does represent a moment of beauty I want to experience. So that's where we're going to pick up. I love, and I do love that Ron and Hermione are going to go to the Dursleys with him, which is very different from the movie. So I'm really excited to see how that kind of plays out and how we kick off the next book. I have a feeling we're going to really hit the ground running with this book more so than we have any of the others. So I'm excited to see what happens.
Yay. Yeah, me too. And I think the thing that, as we came to the end, one of the things, I think this book became colored by the movie, which I think the movie just kind of sucks. It's just not a very good adaptation, and it's my least favorite of the films. It has some okay things in it, but I feel like this book, there's just so much that's kind of, again, missing from it that's really important, and a lot of it's character stuff. There's, you know, the all of the different memories that we're not seeing in the movie as well. And so, yeah, this book is much better than the movie. And I feel like just it leaves a much better taste for this book in my mouth than than I thought I had.
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because I also think that the movie being so poor is a culmination of having to glean out and all the decisions you make in the first movie affect this movie, right? Which happens when you have a series of movies, a trilogy, or what did we end up with, like 8 movies for this one? When you have so many things, every little decision you make along the way affects the end product. And I think the fact that they took the last movie and split it, or the last book and split it into 2 movies, they didn't have to take out quite as much. And they still took out a lot, which we'll go into because there's a lot in this last book. But this one, I think, is the crux of the like losing out on all that stuff we had to cut early on in order to make streamlined movies. And this is really where we feel that the most, is that movie. So, yeah, I mean, none of the movies really give me a terrible taste in my mouth, only because I still love them all. But yeah, I agree. This one does not do the book nearly as much justice as some of the other ones maybe you can get away with. Although I do know you really hate the end of the fifth one.
I do hate the end, but you really hate the end of that. It's my favorite of the movies, though, because the rest of it, I felt like they did a really great job of like taking what is a very difficult book and really bringing forth, I thought, all the character moments except for the very end. It's like,
except for the very end.
You had it perfect and then you squashed it. So I'm really excited because, you know, getting into the last book too, I mean, I actually really like the first movie in that they did of the book, but then the second movie, again, the end screws with,
well, they take a lot of liberties in the last half of it.
Anyway, but we're getting ahead of ourselves, guys. When we get into the Deathly Hallows, but so fun being with you through this book. And so, Drea, as we look forward to that next week, where can people catch up with you if they want to talk some Harry Potter, or just maybe they just want to talk to somebody?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero. I'm all under the name MattRushing02 here on the network doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we are talking about Star Wars each and every week. So that's a lot of fun. And, you know, if you like some Star Wars, that's the place for you. You can also find me over on the Trek FM network doing 2 shows. One is called The Orb with Chris Jones. We're talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I do our General Geek show, the 602 Club, where we talk about all of the fandoms we love. And then who knows when we'll be back. It's been kind of hard because we record in person, but I do Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney, where we talk about films through the lens of faith. But we do want to say thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.